It's your last chance, Hotshot.
For what?
Zombie takeout.
In America, that died a long time ago.
Hello and welcome to episode 510 of Zombie Takeout, the B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
Hello, I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, I actually watched movies between episodes and not just the movies for Zombie Takeout.
What?
That is a very rare thing for me. And I think for you as well.
Yeah, I wish I watched more movies.
The night after we recorded, I rewatched How to Grow a Band, the Punch Brothers documentary.
Oh, wow.
I just want to give that another plug, particularly if you're a Punch Brothers fan. It is a must-see. But even if you're an artist or just want some insight into how artists think, it is such a great character study of an artist who is too wedded to his vision. I was thinking about that scene in the car where the former bass player and, well, the band leader, Chris Thiele, composed this four-part suite about his divorce called The Blind Leaving the Blind. They're a progressive bluegrass band, and
right.
Parts of this piece are avant-garde for modern classical. And he insisted on playing it front to back at every show, and audiences were not having it. So their former bassist, Greg Garrison, and Thiele get into this argument in the van on the way to a show, where Garrison's really just saying, how about we break it up throughout the show with, you know, more accessible material? And Thiele was just obsessed with, no, we have to play it front to back. That's my vision. As an artist, I can see both sides.
All right. You know, it's about, you know, whether you want to actually sell your stuff or whether, you know, you want to just stick to your vision as you originally had it.
The reason I'm really bringing this up is since we reviewed it, I've seen full concerts of theirs on YouTube a few times. And I don't think I've ever seen them play any of The Blind Leaving the Blind. I know I've never seen them play it front to back in any of those shows. So I think Greg Garrison may have won that argument after leaving the band. I also want to take issue again with your idea that mindless movies have no place. I was dealing with a pretty intense bout of depression over the weekend. And so I just wanted something mindless and familiar. I put on Cars, which, to be fair, is probably the weakest and definitely the latest of the Pixar movies.
Okay, yeah.
And it definitely helped. It, you know, helped me shut my brain down. I also did it with a couple of the Kelvin Durst movies, particularly Beyond, which I'm not going to say is brainless, but it's very familiar to me. I've seen it a bunch of times, so it was just fun and familiar. And
but
it
wait,
allowed
we're
me to
review that next week, aren't we?
No, Beyond, I see in the Darkness, I meant Beyond.
Oh,
the
okay,
third one.
Okay.
The third one, which we will be reviewing by the end of the year.
I get the two confused, so you might have said the right one.
Beyond is the third one.
All right.
I've seen it a bunch of times, so it's just very familiar. Movies that are either brainless or just give you what you want or what you expect, they're very relaxing.
It just feels like we have more of them now than...
Perhaps there's a glut, but I think there's always been a glut of those. We just forget them easily.
You know, what's been funny is if you go online and there's a story about the writer's strike, a lot of the people say, well, good, because, you know, all they're doing is writing just this junk and stuff, as if writers are greenlighting their own material.
Right.
As if a writer is sitting out there going, you know what, instead of using my own idea that I have, why don't I just write this shitty thing that's more accessible and mindless and I can get that in. It's the executive, of course,
right,
that wants that.
And I think that's always been the case. Think about early 60s pop music. How much horrible early 60s pop music is there? We remember maybe a tenth, the maybe tenth of it that was good.
Oh, it's any pop music, really.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much bad pop music that it just gets forgotten because it's so bad.
And I think that's been the bulk of movies and TV for time immemorial, as long as movies and TV have existed, and recorded music. It's just that the good stuff is what gets remembered.
Yeah, and we hold on to it.
Thing is, most people only want the familiar stuff, the comfortable, brainless stuff.
Like I would say with music in the 70s, there are probably more people listening to Tony Orlando and Dawn than Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin.
Right. more on that during the hearing. I want to continue our post-show discussion from last week a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think most people want that brain off, it looks pretty experience. Most people don't engage with media like we do. That's why we do review shows, because nature, we heavily engage.
I get, you know, passionate about it, and if it's just, I mean, if there's nothing there, I'm not going to get passionate about it.
I think that was Kevin Feige's masterstroke with the MCU. He managed to dumb them down enough to appeal to the general public and give most people that fun, colorful, satisfying experience while not fucking them up enough to turn off the fans.
Yeah.
He managed to serve both.
For the fans, as long as you're sticking with the source material as closely as possible, you're not going to have a problem with them.
Because even, you know, Batman, Burton's first Batman, and the first two X-Men movies, the origin of good comic book movies, they still played more to the geeks.
Of course.
This was before all of that was mainstream.
Yeah.
I remember when the X-Men movies were announced, sitting around debating who should play Wolverine. Glenn Danzig was a common common favorite because of his size and build.
But can he act at all?
I don't know, but he's like built like Wolverine should be.
Remotely.
And what's his last name? Hugh Jackman. A great job. I'm just saying that, you know, most people want that experience. It has its place, particularly in my situation, because it's just, it relieves stress. Another thing I watched a little bit of during that time was a couple of scenes of Into Darkness, Star Trek Into Darkness, which we will be reviewing next week. I was watching that, and then there was a technical issue on Pluto. It stopped playing, so I went to the in-demand section and watched Beyond.
Because it was no longer a planet? Okay.
Sure. One, I'm not going to spoil too much
I'm
here.
I'm a bad guy.
I'm not going to spoil anything here, because everybody knows Cumberbatch is in the film.
Yeah. Wait, Cumberbatch is playing Cotton? No, I'm just kidding.
Everybody knows that by now, I think. Anybody who cares about that movie knows he's playing Khan. And
I think I saw the damn thing in the theater.
Aside from that almost comically inappropriate casting, a white British guy is a canonically Indian character. The other problem with it, you saw that in the theater. I know we reviewed 09, and they all have the same tone, the same vibe.
Yeah.
The Kelvinverse movies are very quick and very light, which works well for that cast and for that era. I think that tone fits TOS very nicely.
Yeah.
Thing about Cumberbatch, and he's a great actor, but everything he does has gravity.
Hmm. Well, they kind of needed that for a villain, though, you know?
But it just doesn't fit in that world. I mean, they managed to make Nimoy light. And Nimoy has a lot of gravity. But they edited him right to make him fit that tone. They did not edit Cumberbatch well to fit that tone. It's like watching molasses pour around water. He's the opposite of what they needed for that movie. Just something to think about until next week. And finally, on to this week's movie, which is from 1996, Escape from L.A. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by The Past. It's really best left there.
And also brought to you by Matches. You really never know when you could use a good set of matches. All right, so I took some time out to listen to our review of Escape from New York.
I meant to, but I got bogged down. I was listening to a couple of other... Oh, I wanted to listen to the Pirate Hardcore Band, of course. I listened to The Police. We'll get to that in the hearing. I did not listen to this one.
Episode 80,
I did check the ratings.
It was an innocent time. It was May 24th of 2011.
I suspect, I hope, we'll both be rating this significantly lower than we did Escape from New York.
The elements being similar are very interesting. Like, you know, the cheesiness, the effects. I mean, even for 81, we thought the effects were cheesy in Escape from New York.
There was one element where they were very prescient. It's one of the few points I'm giving them.
The cast, they've had an all-star cast then too. Mm-hmm. Ernest Borgnine, Isaac Hayes, Lee Van Cleef.
Were they? Well, okay, Van Cleef was certainly a star. I think a lot of them made their name on that movie.
No, Isaac Hayes.
Well, Isaac Hayes and Lee Van Cleef.
Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah,
Donald Pleasance.
I'm thinking like Adrian Barbeau and maybe Kurt Russell. Although Kurt Russell was a child star, but anyway.
Well, right. Barbeau had like, I forgot what she had. Oh, she'd Maud and stuff like that. And by the way, for the TV show, one of these studies, we should do The Master.
Yeah, definitely.
Because we talked about it during that.
Yeah.
That Maud, show.
Maud might be interesting to revisit also.
Where I was all like fanboying the Master. Yeah. And I think I still would, honestly. But I have no idea. I have not seen this show in like 30 years.
If we can find it, I think it is on the list.
Or 35 years.
Yeah, if we can find it, we definitely have to revisit it. Anyway.
All right. So on to this one. So it is the... it starts off... Man. It is... One of my titles was Too Soon.
Yeah.
And the joke there, of course, is he's talking about shit that pretty much hasn't happened yet, that does happen in a different way. And, you know.
The movie starts by announcing that L.A. was broken off from the continental U.S. by the big earthquake.
Right. In 2000, we had, instead of, you know, 9/11 in 2001, it's L.A. has... A terrible earthquake that finally splits it off.
It's the big one, Elizabeth.
And yeah, and they show some of it. And of course, you know, pre-9/11 movies, you know, they just gleefully destroy things in the U.S. mindlessly.
Right.
Not really thinking that something like this could happen. And seeing it after something like this has happened kind of makes you go...
Well, I wasn't even talking about a natural disaster because, yes, it's very likely that parts of California will become an island
some
point in the future.
There's Santa Ana fire too in this. Yeah. I mean,
I was talking about who takes power in the wake of the earthquake.
Well, exactly. It's you know, we had 9/11 and it's, you know, kind of taking us down that path. I mean, granted, it's 22 years later instead of 13 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
But it eventually leads to fascism. Mm-hmm. And
specifically a Christian nationalist fascist.
Yes. Yes. He's kind of... it feels like he's... In appearance-wise, he's modeled off of Reagan, but more of like a... You know, Jerry Falwell becomes president kind of thing.
Played by the great Cliff Robertson.
You know, I don't remember him. I mean, he looks familiar, but I don't remember him in anything else. I didn't get a chance.
Lots of TV stuff.
Okay. And so it's very similar to the first one, where only this time it's the president's daughter is in there. But there's no fake or anything. It's like, you know... He wants Snake to kill him. You know, they even did the bit with, like, they injected Snake with something in the first one, too.
Yeah.
They follow that. Like, I think in the first one, it was an explosive.
Right, right.
That would detonate. And this time, they go with the virus, which he just gets from a little scratch. And I guess, you know, I was going to go, also actually.
Too soon.
Yeah, too soon. Yeah, I was going to say, actually, it does kind of work like that. It could. And it's the other funny thing is that they give the game up that, you know, that it's not real, like, halfway through. Yeah. And they just seem to ignore it when they say this, you know. Snake just, it goes in one ear and out the other. when it turns out to actually be fake, he's like, oh. So he's sent into the prison, which is now L.A. It's funny that I had a problem with them writing off New York as a prison in the first movie.
It's not so much a prison as much as it's what England did with Australia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's just they deport any immoral Americans.
Any undesirables were shipped there.
The undesirables to L.A., which is an island. And there's some MacGuffin that they don't explain right off the top, but they give up the game really soon into it as to what it is. It's some sort of satellite targeting thing that turns off power in either
It's an EMP. The president's daughter, in protest of his fascism, steals this EMP weapon and runs off to L.A. to be with the villain.
And there was also another member of a team that was sent in earlier.
Yeah.
Which, did I miss them showing the person that was sent in that he, you know?
They were sent in before Snake was brought into the picture. We didn't see that until he finds the body.
Okay, that's what it was. He just found the dead body already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I was kind of like, you know, what? Like, he was close to it, and then he said something about using it for target. They're about to use him for target practice, but he was already dead at that point anyway.
Yeah, okay. I never saw them alive.
All right, so that's like that's a dead end. That's kind of what I thought was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's really no head fakes. I think they kill off more people than you think they're going to kill off. That was the only real swerves you see. That there's people that die that you don't expect to die.
Right.
Into it, you know. A weird cameo by Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, and a weird cameo by Peter Fonda.
Yeah, who almost steals the movie, really.
I don't know who they were trying to sell the movie to with him, because boomers were a bit of the audience from the original.
Well, yeah, since they're coming from the original.
Yeah.
So they get the MacGuffin, they make it back, and a lot of the similar things, a lot of switcheroos, which they pretty much did in the first one, too.
Mm-hmm.
They do it all over again, and hilarity ensues.
Yeah. Saw this one in the theater in 96. Thought it was mediocre at the time. 27 years did not do it any favors. Escape from L.A. was in development for over 10 years. In 1987, screenwriter Coleman Luck was commissioned to write a screenplay for the film, with Dino De Laurentiis' company producing, which Carpenter later described as too late and too campy. We could have had a De Laurentiis version of this.
Which might have made this even better.
Absolutely. I was not expecting much going in, but it still failed to meet my expectations.
Huh.
But yeah, the Christian nationalist president, terrifyingly accurate. Especially since he became president for life and created this new moral America. Terrifying. The earthquake looked good, except for the building coming down in the wave. It was just really obvious CG.
Oh, the CG in this is horrendous. I like remember like last week, I was like, so this is 3 years before Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
One would not guess that.
Oh, Buffy was a year later and had better CG on a TV
right. budget. I mean, there's a lot of really bad CG in this movie, from the helicopters to the satellites to...
So he sets Escape from New York 15 years in the future. It was 96 when the shit hit the fan.
Yeah.
This was 20 years in the future from when it was made, roughly.
Right, and there's this weird thing where people... are like look at a walkie-talkie strange.
17 technically, so about the same distance in the future. It's the same argument I've had many times as setting sci-fi in the near future or giving it a specific year. You're gonna hit that year and it's not gonna be real, and it's gonna take away from the immersion.
Right. We had the same problem with the first one, and he just doubled down on this, which is really weird.
Yeah. I like a lot of the dramatic music cues. When Snake shows up at first, we get this nice dramatic music. We get this nice sort of Middle Eastern stuff when he's at sunset.
And the similarities between last week's movie and this week's movie, was that why we were doing these back to back?
I don't think that was intentional, but it worked out kind of well. Well, it worked out well, except we had to sit through both of them.
Yeah.
I forgot that his first name was Bob. Bob. Always get a kick out of that. Probably made the same comment in the last one. Playing off the electrocutions at the beginning was very Troma, which I kind of liked. Yeah. It surprised me.
Yeah.
I was totally rooting for the president's daughter, of course. have to take issue with them making the anti-theocratic revolutionary the villain.
It's very strange. Well, first of all, to be that on the nose that he's Che Guevara, you know?
Yeah.
That was kind down of ridiculous. Down to
the beret.
Like, why would they be like that, you know?
When, as soon as I saw who the villain was, I'm like, I may have issues with this movie. I'm wondering if his characterization, so being so on the nose, was a reaction to all the Che t-shirts that were popular in the 90s.
Maybe. And Shining Path, you know, is a real, you know, terrorist organization from the 90s as well. So just to bring that in, like they're somehow still around in this future.
Right.
Remember, this is supposed to be a post-nuclear war. You know, like, Escape from New York, the whole point of that was that the army was fighting the Russians.
Right.
And Snake was the only person available to send in. Mm-hmm. And now this, they're playing up like the nuclear war never really happened.
Right. I did like the head fakes with the holograms and the blanks. It was nice to see Michelle Forbes. Always liked her on Star Trek.
And they drove the holograms thing so much that it was kind of like...
Kind of overdid it eventually.
You knew that was how the ending was going to be.
There was no surprise at the end, except the very end, which cost it a brain.
Like, once they killed off the people that you didn't expect to die off, you knew exactly how the movie was going to end.
Yeah. The sub looked horrible, but amusingly so. I liked the shark trying to bite the sub. That was a nice moment. But the asylum does better effects than some of the stuff with the sub.
Yeah. Like, I mean, was he purposely going low budget just to match the first movie?
Maybe.
I don't know. Like, it seems like in the 90s, people would expect more.
A lot about this movie confused me.
Yeah.
I did like the I thought you'd be taller joke in place of the I thought you were dead joke.
And what happened in Cleveland? Mm-hmm.
Everything about Snake feels dated.
I don't know. It seems off in this movie, you know?
He is just so very 80s.
He's got a cold.
Doesn't work in any other era, particularly not now. I do like the soundtrack. Great to hear Tool.
Tool was good, but a lot of the soundtrack, I mean...
There was a song playing in a car that drove past him. 10 seconds down is all you hear of the lyric. And
control.
I had to look that up because I was curious who it was. It wasn't terribly interesting, but I was just curious because they sounded familiar. It was Sugar Ray.
Yeah, this, I mean...
Sugar Ray, before they went pop, they were like a punk metal band. I was just really kind of interested in hearing them before they went punk, because I've never heard their early stuff.
A lot of 90s music that just needed to stay in the 90s.
I can never criticize Tool.
Tool is the exception, of course.
And the Sugar Ray just caught my attention because I was surprised by to hear them using distortion and not playing pop.
Yeah.
The crucified team member, the rescue team member, was very B-movie. He was crucified on a wall and they were throwing knives at him.
Like I said, I pretty much missed it. I didn't, like, it was just lost in kind of the shuffle of the scene when he arrives there.
And coding all of the bad guys, Cuervo is the name of the Che Guevara stand-in. And all of his subordinates are all Latinx really does not work these days.
It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's just too cheesy even for them.
I enjoyed Campbell's cameo. That whole thing was just weird and unexpected.
And think about it, to go from Isaac Hayes in the first one to a Che Guevara, you know, impersonator, it's just not as good. It's a definite downgrade.
Yeah,
there wasn't really any sense that this guy was a badass, really.
They frigid a Muslim woman right after she tries to open Snake's mind about what LA could be.
Which, I mean, it was kind of, that was a turn I was not expecting. Even though I damn well should have, because it was like, you could have this whole life here and be happy. It's like, I should have seen that coming from a mile away, that, well, of course you can't. You know, it's George Lazenby, James Bond.
And that whole idea of a dark paradise, ultimate freedom. Basically, the idea was that in LA, anybody can do whatever they want. There's no fascist government controlling people's lives. Thing is, that ultimate freedom, anarchist kind of Wild West argument really only works for people who already have power.
Yeah. And speaking of James Bond, wouldn't it have been really funny if he never used any of the James Bond devices that he introduced at the beginning? Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, I want to make that movie where somebody is like given like all of these devices, and then they just lose them.
Or just
10 minutes in,
he's looking at it while driving, tosses it over his shoulder. You cut to the back seat. There's just a pile of gadgets,
and the car blows up.
Yeah.
Never get used.
EMPs were kind of an original idea in 96. They got overused later, but kind of new for that time. The surfing scene just was ridiculous. They surfed giant... Snake and Peter Fonda surf this giant wave, and they use it to chase a car.
The things of LA that they shoehorned in is... it's kind of like the first one where they were shoehorning all the New York things in.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the surfing scene was not... It was interesting,
It was fun. I have to admit I liked it, even though the CG was hideous. Although uncredited, Tony Hawk has claimed that he and fellow professional skateboarder Chris Miller worked as stunt doubles on that scene.
It was the basketball scene that was... really bad. Just embarrassing. I mean, I get it. They like basketball in LA. Yeah, like New York, they totally don't like basketball. They don't win, but they love basketball in New York.
It's kind of like saying nobody but San Francisco liked football in the 80s.
Well, right. It's, and just to work that into the... It just shoehorned in the basketball of death, which is...
Nobody but half of New York ever liked baseball. Gotta say, I appreciate that they worked a trans woman into the story and didn't play her off as a joke or a bad guy. She was played, Greer, right? Yeah, she was played by Pam Grier, a cis woman. A little problematic, but for the time, okay. I just like that they didn't make her the butt of a joke or a villain.
I mean, Pliskin was kind of, which, I mean, I guess.
Well, because he knew her before she transitioned. So that would be a weird thing to get your head around if you didn't know that it happened. It would take some time. I'm okay with that. The hang gliding was just utterly ridiculous.
I like the hang gliding assaults.
They were talking in a very normal conversational tone while on hang gliders. And the hang gliders were just staying up indefinitely and swooping and making these maneuvers that, like jets couldn't make.
Like they had a motor.
Yeah. Carpenter recalled that the theme park scene shot at night on a Universal backlot resulted in a noise complaint from Rick Dees, which forced them to cease using live ammo. Yes, that Rick Dees.
Oh, wow. So I guess Rick Dees lives near Universal
Apparently,
Studios.
not really an interesting bit of trivia until you get to the Rick Dees part, if you remember Rick Dees.
Right.
By the way, A.J. Langer, who played the president's daughter, most known for My So-Called Life.
Okay, I was trying to think of where I knew her from, and she hasn't did anything in like 10 years.
That's where I'm going. She retired because she married an English noble. She's now the Countess of Devon.
What? Okay.
She married the Earl of Devon. The ending was pretty obvious, but still pretty infuriating. So he, of course, swaps out the remote for this EMP weapon. They end up at the fake. He has the real remote. And if he had destroyed it or used it as an insurance policy, that'd be fine.
But I mean, it's a total Plissken thing to do, what he did.
He puts in the code for the world, hits the button, knocks out all of the electricity in the world permanently, and says, "Welcome to humanity." How many people are going to fucking die who are perfectly innocent because of what Snake did?
Of course, in their mind, that he's liberated everyone. Which I don't see exactly how that works because, I mean, don't guns still work?
Well, yeah. And
So,
bats and knives.
right, whoever has weapons will still be the dominant force.
Yes.
In fact, I'm so surprised they didn't just end the movie with them killing him because they still had guns that could fire.
And I mean, granted, the super wealthy don't have cash on hand typically, but lots of people still do, and the cash will still work for
Yeah,
a
well,
while.
they weren't even thinking about electronic money
Yeah,
back
well,
then.
that's true in 96, true.
Yeah.
So lots of people at that point still, in 96, people still had cash on hand for to a large extent. So that cash is still going to work for a while. It'll probably die out eventually. But yeah, there's nothing good about what he did at the end there, and he's supposed to be the good guy.
Kind of, but I think in Kurt Russell's mind, that's the good thing
Anti-hero.
to, yeah.
But yeah, in Russell's mind, because hardcore libertarian.
Yeah.
The thing that gets me is I looked that up. I also looked up Carpenter's politics. Carpenter's notoriously progressive.
Oh, yeah.
But I guess it was of the time and it didn't just didn't age well.
Now, there's people that I feel were underused. Well, maybe not underused, just not used well when they use them. Like Steve Buscemi
Yeah.
and Stacy Keach.
Neither
Yeah.
was underused, just yeah, not used well.
Yeah. Like Buscemi has this character, just kind of like this weasel, you're trying to play both sides sort of thing.
He was a less interesting version of Donnie.
Yeah, exactly.
And Keach was the chief of police, effectively.
Yeah, pretty much the same guy from Cheech and Chong.
Yeah.
Although, he's kind of dressed like Mussolini a bit, to counterbalance the Che Guevara.
I think that's the most annoying. Well, no, the ending, pushing the button was the really annoying part, but the Shay thing is a close second.
Yeah. Oh, that's very annoying, yeah.
Especially when they pit him against a Christian nationalist. Granted, Snake is in the middle. It's kind of that aggressive, moderate approach that a lot of people have.
Right.
Which is really just about as bad as neutrality. It only serves those in power.
And to
Anyway.
use a real, terrorist organization as the other side, which is kind of like a, you're not using like an actual Nazi, party thing. You don't come out and say that. You imply it, by dressing Keach up like Mussolini and the eagle and stuff like that. But you don't come out and say it like you do for the other side.
Sequels and remakes?
Oh God, I hope not. You talked about another one on the other episode of like Gerard Butler was gonna play this at one point.
Of course, this is a sequel to 81's Escape from New York. A
Yeah.
sequel of the movie called Escape from Earth, was meant to be produced after Escape from L.A., but the underperformance of the latter changed the plans. According to Carpenter, Escape from Earth would have picked up with Snake right after the ending of Escape from L.A., which saw him activating a super weapon known as the Sword of Damocles. Escape from Earth was kind of Snake Plissken in a space capsule flying interstellar, so there'd be a lot of special effects in it, which I never cared too much for, but that's what it would look like. I'm getting Thanksgiving 2 vibes.
Kind of, but just not as funny.
No, 2, not 3. 3 was about them trying to get back to and remove it from existence. 2 was the one in space that was so bad they had to remove it from existence. Marvel Comics released the one-shot Adventures of Snake Plissken in January 97. The story takes place sometime between Escape from New York and his famous Cleveland escape mentioned in Escape from L.A. And an Escape from L.A. video game was announced for the Sega Saturn, Sony PlayStation, Panasonic M2, I don't remember that, and PC in 96, but was later canceled. I honestly have no memory of a Panasonic gaming system at that time.
Me neither. And I, played a lot of different gaming systems in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, on to Brains.
On to Brains.
It was a 3 up until that last minute. I'm going 2. So I'm giving it a little bit for some fun, campy stuff. A little bit for the prescience of the Christian nationalism. And a little bit for the trans representation. But that's really just 2.
For the most part, it's, well, for some of it, it's fun. For some of it, it's just like, wow, that is incredibly stupid. Just the whole concept of, oh, you're going to walk around LA in 8 hours or whatever. You know? Like something that takes forever to get around by car.
I didn't even know that you could drive around LA in 8 hours.
Well, with traffic, no.
Oh, yeah, it's true.
But to walk it, those hills and shit, it's just not going to happen at
all.
LA
is a car city because it's too fucking big to walk around.
Right. So the idea...
And presumably their mass transit sucks.
Of walking around it in 8 hours is just dumb from the start.
Mm. Which should be the tagline of this movie, dumb from the start.
Yeah. So I'm going 2.5.
All right. And what have we learned?
2013 technology. It's only 17 years into the future.
And I learned that a mediocre movie doesn't get better after nearly 30 years.
It's a shame that we did not get the virtual reality that they have in this.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I mean, that was pretty good looking stuff.
Yeah, it was basically a holodeck.
Yeah.
And that's a great segue, because that's it for Escape from L.A., but until next time when we'll be reviewing Star Trek Into Darkness, granted, a little bit before the holodeck in terms of setting, but still, it's a Star Trek thing. Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.